fabulous introduction. I'm never going to live up to that. So keep your expectations low. Let me begin with a poem which I haven't expected to read, but which I must, I think. Quiff. How often have I carried our family word for the hot water bottle to a strange bed, as my father would juggle a red hot half brick in an old sock to his childhood settle. I have taken it into so many lovely hands, or laid it between us like a sword. A hotel room in New York City with a girl who spoke hardly any English. My hand on her breast like the smoldering one-off spur of the Yeti. Or some other shy beast that is yet to enter the language. The Hrathgar in Sale is Hage and Rich Marsmal. Alistrin Kaiser is a Maid Shin a V Nabarch. Tam Char Nefer is Veich and Three Murta. Is Nasasani Fain the Vager Gawaiadish Boss. A quatrain or burden generally ascribed to Vaughan Rua O'Sullivan, and as many of you will know. And over the course of this year of commemoration and celebration, I attempted to do some variations on that quatrain by Vaughan Rua. Of course, the first thing I heard was from a scholar of these matters who told me that, in fact, it was extremely unlikely that Vaughan Rua had ever written this at all. This kind of should have put the kibosh on my efforts, but I'm sort of brazening it out. I think maybe if I publish it again, I'll describe it as being ascribed to. I'm welcome to suggestions as to how I'm going to get around this problem. I'll read a few sections of it, read a couple of other things, read a couple more sections of it, read a couple of other things, and then come back to it. No, I know that sounds as if we might be here all night, which we might be, but not on my account. On Easter Monday, I was still en route from Drumcondra to the GPO, when I overheard a dispute between a starched shirt cuckoo and a meadow pipit. The pipit singing even as it flew between its perch on a wicker-covered carboy and the nest it had improvised near a clump of gorse from strands of linen spun by Henry Joy and the mane of a stalking horse. The cuckoo that had shouldered out the hoi polloi, showing not a hint of remorse. Now the world's been brought low, the wind's heavy with soot. Alexander and Caesar, all their retinue. We've seen Tara buried in grass, Troy trampled underfoot. The English, their days are numbered too. Of the 900 Mauser rifles Erskine Childers and the boys uploaded from the Asgard and Hoth, most were deployed to the volunteers. Childers traced Hoth to its source in the Old Norse, the Vikings being among the first to beat their plowshares into swords. On account of his opposition to it, the headstrong O'Rahilly was simply not made aware of the impending ding-dong. Even though the blacksmiths on Mountjoy Square had been going at it hammer and tongs. The wind blows ash, now the world's completely destroyed. Alexander, Caesar, each leading a mighty force. Tara is overgrown. Look at the cut of Troy. With the English, things may eventually take their course. At Jacob's Biscuit Factory, Thomas McDonough sends up a flare through the arrowroot-scented air. On Stephen's Green, meanwhile, the English try to wrong-foot us by launching a two-pronged attack on our trenches. The more we're spurned, Roger Casement once opined, the more we're engrossed. His submarine, shaking from stem to stern as it hugged the Kerry coast, the least stone, he went on, the least stone in a cairn is entitled to make one boast. The whole world lay waste. Cinders flying through the air, Caesar and Alexander and their battle throngs. There's hardly a trace of Tara. Troy's barely there. The English themselves will shortly be moving along. I've read away from it just to read a poem called Anshaw, which of course features one of the great patriots of that era, or at least features his name. There's someone here called Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward, who of course aspires to some of the ambitions of the leaders of the rising. He is interested in militant republicanism. Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward, Anshaw. When the master was calling the roll at the primary school in College Lands, you were meant to call back Anshaw and raise your hand as your name occurred. Anshaw meaning here, here and now, all present and correct, was the first word of Irish I spoke. The last name on the ledger belonged to Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward and was followed, as often as not, by silence, knowing looks, a nod and a wink, the master's droll, and where's our little ward of court? I remember the first time he came back, the master had sent him out along the hedges to weigh up for himself and cut a stick with which he would be beaten. After a while, nothing was spoken. He would arrive as a matter of course with an ash plant, a sally rod, or finally the hazel wand he had whittled down to a whiplash. Its twist of red and yellow lacquers, sanded and polished, and altogether so delicately wrought that he had engraved his initials on it. I last met Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward in a pub just over the Irish border. He was living in the open, in a secret camp on the other side of the mountain. He was fighting for Ireland, making things happen. And he told me, Joe Ward, of how he had risen through the ranks to quartermaster, commandant. How every morning at parade, his volunteers would call back Anshaw and raise their hands as their names occurred. Thank you. Why Bromley left, and where he went is a mystery even now. For if a man should have been content, it was him. 2 acres of barley, 1 of potatoes, 4 bullocks, a milker, a slated farmhouse. He was last seen going out to plough on a March morning, bright and early. By noon, Brownlee was famous. They had found all abandoned, with the last rig unbroken, his pair of black horses, like man and wife, shifting their weight from foot to foot and gazing into the future.
Thank you, thank you.
Rather than adjourn to a gin palace for which so many yearned, Joseph Mary Plunkett has adjourned to the GPO, where the O'Rahilly's now doing his utmost to shove himself from pillar to post in his newfound zeal to throw off the English yoke and settle our old score. On Sackville Street, a girl who seemed to be about to choke has coughed up something from her very core. She wipes her mouth on her jute cloak and reloads her grandfather's 4-bore. The sky is full of coal dust. The old orders overturned. Caesar and Alexander, their massed hosts. Tara was burned. Troy was burned. One of these days, the English will give up the ghost. I've watched Countess Markievicz striding through the oaks where our aspirations turn out to be pigs in pokes. This rifle was used against the Muslim sepoys in Cawnpore before being turned on the Boers, but that its firing pin is sticking is a sign of a more general morass in which we founder. The thin red line at Balaclava is testimony less to the officer class than the rank and file. The din of the sacking of Sackville Street, looters, broken glass, the world laid waste, the wind heavy with smoke. Alexander the Great, Great Caesar, their assorted core. Tara is buried under grass. Even Troy's defences broke. In the case of the English, much the same lies in store. Are you getting the idea here?
Yeah. Oh yeah!
McDonough's tapping out some rhythmic verse on a biscuit tin. In Cawnpore, the sepoys were each sewn into a pigskin before being hanged en masse. On Stephen's Green, we got a whiff of that chlorine gas with its distinctive pepper pineapple smell. The meadow peppet was shaking from stern to stem as she pointed to the shell of the cuckoo's egg she'd been condemned to billet. As a dead horse's belly swells, it pushes a sniper out of his nest into murder and mayhem. The wind, all smut and smur. The world spins out of control. Alexander and Caesar, their gangs under grass like Tara of the Kings. Have you seen the shape Troy's in? As for the English, that cup too will pass. Let me read something slightly lighter. Symposium. As you know, a symposium is a philosophical discussion taking place over a couple of pints of Beamish or a glass or two of wine or whatever it might be. You can lead a horse to water, but You can't make it hold its nose to the grindstone and hunt with the hounds. Every dog has a stitch in time. Two heads, you've been sold one good turn. One good turn deserves a bird in the hand. A bird in the hand is better than no brand. To have your cake is to pay Paul. Make hay while you can still hit the nail on the head. For want of a nail, the sky might fall. People in glass houses can't see the wood for the new broom. Rome wasn't built between two stools. Empty vessels wait for no man. A hair of the dog is a friend indeed. There's no fool like the fool who shot his bolt. There's no smoke after the horse is gone. Here's another horsey poem. I lived for a few years in New Jersey in a house which was built, the oldest part of it was built about 1750. And in that part of the world, when they were building a house then, they were inclined to incorporate a lot of horse hair into the plaster of the wall. And from time to time, when we were doing a few renovations or whatever, be conscious of the horse hair and the skin of the that's a good idea. Thank you. the skin of the house, as it were. So this is a poem about a series of impressions through a hole in a wall. I mention an instance of contemporary famine in Africa. I mention the Irish navvies who came down the road in the 1830s and dug the Raritan and Delaware and Raritan Canal. Many of them dying, some of them from cholera, many of them from just the severity of the work, and many of them buried around the place, many of them speaking Irish. I used to have a sense that I heard them the times. In any case, so, the loaf. When I put my finger to the hole, they've cut for a dimmer switch in a wall of plaster stiffened with horse hair. It seems I've scratched a 200-year-old itch with a pink and a pink and a pinky pick. When I put my ear to the hole, I'm suddenly aware of spades and shovels turning up the game, all the way from Raritan to the Delaware, with a clink and a clink and a clinky click. When I put my nose to the hole, I smell the floodplain off the canal after a hurricane, and the spots of green grass where thousands of Irish have lain, with a stink and a stink and a stinky stick. When I put my eye to the hole, I see one holding horse dung to the rain, in the hope indeed of washing out a few whole ears of grain, with a wink and a wink and a winky wink. And when I do at last succeed in putting my mouth to the horsehair fringed niche. I can taste the small loaf of bread he baked from that whole seed. With a link and a link and a linky link. Now, this next one also has a slightly kind of nonsense refrain, like many songs. And it's a poem which features my son. He's about 10, I think, at the time. And it's a poem that uses a couple of words which are not so common, I think, nowadays. One of them is, look at the myself, where is it? Flummery. Another, Samhain's, both of these referring to the same dish eaten around Samhain, around Halloween, and a dish of some kind of corn mush. I don't know, are any of you familiar with it? Have you eaten Samhain's? No, what do you say?
Curds.
Is Samhain's a dairy product? Is it? I thought it was more a wheat product.
It's grass.
A wheat product. It's not much eaten in this enlightened age, I guess. When we're lucky enough not to have to eat it, perhaps. For the most part. This is a poem called At Least They Weren't Speaking French. It's about a couple of my father's brothers who died. One of them as a child in arms, a babe in arms, another in his early 20s, both of them from problems that, you know, would probably in this era be easily fixed with antibiotics. They just weren't available. At least they weren't speaking French. At least they weren't speaking French. When my father sat with his brothers and sisters, two of each, on a ramshackle bench at the end of a lane marked by two white stones, and made mouth music. Ovale? As they waited, chilled to the bone, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol-de-o. For the bus meant to bring their parents back from town. It came and went. Nothing. One sister was weighed down by the youngest child. A grocery bag from a town more distant still, in troth. What started as a cough, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol-de-o, would briefly push him forward to some minor renown, then shove him back, oddly summery, down along the trench to that far-flung realm where, at least, they weren't speaking French. At least they weren't speaking French when another brother, 20-something, stepped on a nail no one had bothered to clench, on a plank thrown half-heartedly from the known to the unknown, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol-de-o, across a drainage ditch on a building site. His nut-brown arm, his leg nut-brown. That nail, sheathed in a fine down, would take no more than a week or 10 days to burgeon from the froth of that piddling little runoff, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol-de-o, and make of him a green and burning tree, his septicemia crown. Sounds as much as he could manage, trying to keep that flummery down as much as any of them could manage. However they might describe the stench, as exhalation, as odor, at least they weren't speaking French. At least they weren't speaking French, but those 20-something council workers, one with a winch, the other a wrench, would point my son and me to a long, overgrown lane marked by two faded stones, folderol, folderol, folderol de yellow, like two white-faced clowns gaping at the generations who pass between them and set down bag after grocery bag, setting them on the table, the newspaper tablecloth, not the 1976, not the East Tyrone Brigade, not Bader Meinhof, folderol, folderol, folderondio, bringing the suggestion of a frown to those two mummer stones, still trying to lie low, trying to keep their mummery down to a bare minimum. Two stones that, were they to speak, might blench as much at their own giving out as our taking in, that at least they weren't speaking French. That's a poem about my son. I'll read one about my daughter, and then we'll finish the two or three sections from the Owen Rua variations, and then we'll have the open mic. This one's called Cuba. It's called Cuba 2, actually. I wrote a poem called Cuba years ago, and about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And my daughter and myself went to Cuba, 2012. And we went to the Havana Jazz Festival. One still had to have a pretext of some artistic pretext. I think that's changed now, more or less. But in any case, it's just a run around Cuba. Cuba to, I'm hanging with my daughter in downtown Havana. She's worried people think she's my mail order bride. It might be the Anshaw tattooed on her ankle. It might be the tie-in with that poem of mine. The 59 Buicks, the 59 Chevys, the 59 Studebakers with their white-walled wheels, the rain-bleached streets have been put through a mangle. The sugar mills, too, are feeling the squeeze. We touch on how Ireland will be inundated long before the nil-nil draw. Che Guevara's father was one of the Galway lynchers. Now a genetically engineered catfish can crawl on its belly like an old school gorilla. Maybe a diminished seventh isn't the note a half-decent revolution should end on. The poor with their hands out for pencils and soap. Hopped up though I am on caffeine, I've suffered all my life from post-traumatic fatigue. Even a world-class sleeper like Rip Van Winkle was out of it for only 20 years. A fillet of the fenny cobra may yet fold into a blood pressure drug. A passion for marijuana may yet be nipped in the bud. Some are here for a nose job, some a torn meniscus. The profits from health tourism have been salted away. The blue scorpion takes the sting from one cancer. Ovarian may yet leave us unfazed. I didn't bother you with any poems about ovarian cancer. You'll be glad to know. Hemingway's sun hat What do you say?
Meniscus. Meniscus, I love that word.
Thank you. Hemingway's sun hat is woven from raffia. He's tried everything to stop the rot. He's cut everything back to the bare essentials. His 55 Chryslers in the shop. We'll sit with Hemingway through yet another evening of trying to stay off the rum. I'm running down the list of my uncles. It was Uncle Pat who was marked by a gun. Our friends Mayor Lansky and the Jewish Mafia built the Riviera as a gambling club. Had it not been for the time differential, Uncle Arnie might have taken a cut. My wife is related to a fellow called Arnold Rothstein, who's the guy who fixed the World Series sometime back then, but we don't talk much about it. I suppose I've forgotten that this has been recorded, but there you are.
We'll cut that out.
The best baseball bats are turned from hibiscus. They're good against people who get in your way. The best poems, meanwhile, give the answers to questions only they have raised. We touch on Bulat and Yevgeny, two Russian friends who've since left town. The Cuban ground iguana is actually quite thin on the ground. The cigars we lit up on President's Avenue have won gold medals in the cigar games. Now it seems a cigar may twinkle all the more as the light fails. My daughters led me through Hemingway's villa to a desk round which dusk drinkers crowd. She insists the anchor on her Achilles tendon represents her being in the here and now. The cattle egret is especially elated that a plough may yet be yoked to an ox. Others sigh for the era of three martini lunches and the Martini Henry single shot. When will we give Rothstein and Lansky and their heavies the collective heave? In Ireland, we need to start now to untangle the rhetoric of 2016. The Riviera's pool is shaped like a coffin. So much has been submerged here since the Bay of Pigs. Maybe that's why the buildings are wrinkled. Maybe that's why the cars have fins. I'll end with my own contribution to the rhetoric of 2016, and thank you very much indeed for having me here in O'Vale. It's been a pleasure hearing you and hearing your marvellous takes on those five words. Very nimble. Must be great to be youthful. In any case, I'm looking forward to hearing some of your poems. I have an early start in the morning, but I still hope to stay to the end. So here we go. McDonough's tapping out some... McDonough's tapping out some rhythmic verse on a biscuit tin. In Conbor, the sepoys were each sown... Actually, I read that, I think, didn't I? See, that is one of the problems about getting old. It really is. It's sort of vague, it seemed vaguely familiar there.
Here we go.
Daniel O'Connell.
All right, sorry.
A lovely fellow, no?
Keep going.
I'm going to check these names. Daniel O'Connell. O'Donovan Rossa. Charles Stewart Parnell. Patrick Pearse is sounding his own death knell as that gob of flame shines on the pavement in Sackville Street. A little gem. On Stephen's Green, one rare moment of mirth comes with a daily ceasefire in which a keeper feeds the dank ducks on their dank pond. For ourselves, there's a dearth of humour. Leave your jewels in the bank, the Countess told the girls. The only thing worth wearing's a revolver. It seems she shot one officer point blank. The whole world's foundering. A smoke trail tells of the fates of Caesar, Alexander, those who kissed their hems. Tara's plowed under. Troy eventually fell. Surely the English will get what's coming to them. The dead horse's swollen belly has now so tightened its girth, it looks as if it might give birth to a replica of itself. In an effort to outflank us, the English have banged out a tank from the smoke boxes of two locomotives. The men with a hand on the tiller were so familiar with Tory sound, they thought nothing of taking command of the Asgard. To be renowned on Tory is to be world renowned. From a burst sandbank, a skein of sand winds as it's unwound. The air tastes of grit. The world offers no safe berth. Tsar Alexander, the Kaiser, their serried ranks. Tara is debased. You see how deep Troy lies beneath the earth. The very English will sink as all those sank. Those who can't afford a uniform may wear a blue armband from which the meadow pipit filches a single strand to bind its nest. The rest of us are bound by honour alone. The English pound the GPO while we ourselves meet brute strength with brute determination. The pipit interweaves wondrous blue and that workaday sandbank jute. That the O'Rahilly was the last to know of the impending to-do, but first to execute the plan of attack is ever so slightly skewed. The world's topsy-turvy, though. This dust's the dust that fanned Caesar and Alexander as each gained ground. Tara's under pasture. At Troy, it's clear how things stand. For the English, perhaps, their time will come around. Thank you very much.